This is Touchstone Talk from the Poetry Society of New Hampshire.
Welcome to Touchstone Talk. This is Nora Smith and Sammy Marcotte, student interns of Touchstone Magazine. And this is Patrice Panette, poet and author of Happiness, a Strange Bird. Thank you so much for being here.
It is a pleasure. So glad to meet you both.
What was it like writing the Happiness, a Strange Bird book?
Oh, that's a great question. There are many ways to answer it. It was so important to me to have an opportunity to bring together poetry from different parts of my life. I had been working on a manuscript for quite a while, especially since going to graduate school, which I did later in life. And I submitted the manuscript not too many times for what it could have been, but each time I revised it, I changed it around, I added new poems. But I finally reached that moment of it's now. There's no more time to hold back. And so I had this opportunity working with Mike Nelson from B. Monk Press, on the Seacoast, actually, the publisher. And it was really great. It was very collaborative. And I had great help with editing, too, which we can go into more detail about. But as the general answer, it was a great experience preparing this manuscript and having it come forth into the world.
Yeah. Do you want to talk a little bit more about that? Like, how long did it take to, like, write, edit, and publish overall?
Well, as I say, the writing took a long time. Mm-hmm. But that was also wonderful because you'll find, and I know you're more at the beginning of your writing careers, there's still a signature voice.
Absolutely,
that you have.
Yeah.
And so it develops, you develop your skills, but there's something innate about each of us, what our voice is, what our concerns are. I don't feel my concerns, my interests, at their deepest, have changed all that much. My expression of them has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there are poems from 15 years ago, maybe a couple even earlier, and many, many, of course, more recently. So the writing part was a process, partly in which I was discovering my power as a writer and how I wanted to form the poems, right? So those skills are still growing, but still, it was wonderful to find a sequence and feel that these poems belong together.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't take so long. It was once I decided now is the time and I have the right publisher and the right situation. It really, I think I began working with Mike like in September, maybe early October, and by January the book was in the world, which, as you know, many, many people experience with more traditional publishing. You know, it's at least a year and many times mm-hmm. longer. So that, it did go quickly. And I had wonderful allies helping me with editing, with design. So I got to have a say in that. And this beautiful cover is from a painting by a dear friend, Joan Hanley, who's just a marvelous artist. And I hesitated to ask her, but I couldn't resist, you know, would it be all right if I used part of a painting of yours as the book cover? And, you know, she was just so generous and happy to say yes. And I feel like it also, aside from the beauty, and of course our listeners can't see, this heron flying low over the water, and a stretch of water, and then sort of a few mountains, and then the sky is dripping. And so you have this feeling from the cover of something beautiful, something marvelous, but there's also something strange and a little bit eerie. Is it still being created, or is it already dissolving? You know, that moment of beauty that we long for. The omen, the good omen of a heron, already she's flying by. And so I felt like it captured a dreamlike feeling that helped me to say what I wanted to about happiness.
That leads me to my next question, actually, is why is happiness a strange bird? And what is the, the theme, you think, or the message you want in the whole book? We will now listen to Happiness, a Strange Bird.
Happiness, a strange bird. Waking up without a cloud, your heart has a feathery feeling, playful even, could take to the sky. But happiness is a strange bird and builds her nest in dangerous places. Also prone to illusion, she attacks the window as if her reflection is an enemy come to steal her territory. Or, seeing an idyllic landscape in the glass, the morning sky, robin's egg blue, is stunned when she tries to pass through. Well, as I shared with you this poem, Happiness, a Strange Bird, the title actually came from an experience of robins building their nest in dangerous places. And the dangerous place in my case was my house. And there were a couple of instances where the robin chose a busy area. It was sort of a flat railing by the front door, and a meter box at the side of the house where the cars pulled in. And so every time with coming and going, the robin would flutter off, and then things would settle down. She'd come back on her eggs. And I was just fascinated. One time, the egg never saw the eggs hatch because nature had other plans for them, apparently, predators. Mm-hmm. And in another case, we saw the just miraculously almost transparent bodies of these baby birds, mm-hmm. and saw the mother feeding, and but never lived to see them fly. They never fledged. For some reason, this struck me as a remarkable metaphor for our longing to birth the important things in our life, take a risk. Our search for happiness is sometimes misguided, sometimes leads us astray, and it's unpredictable. We want happiness, and longing is as frequent, if not more frequent, than the attainment of happiness. There's the disappointment, the frustration, and these fleeting moments which shimmer in memory and, you know, drive us forward for more more tastes of happiness. So I wanted the book to address that universal longing for happiness and delight in it, but also the complexity. That's where the strange bird, why would a robin build her nest in a dangerous, busy place? And I'm sure there are reasons. But like us, we sometimes look for happiness in a place that can even do us harm at times. Mm-hmm. Even the search for love doesn't always lead us where we want it to go. Mm-hmm. So, but one more thing I would say that I hope the book conveys. And while happiness is fleeting by its nature, and there's this wonderful quote from Emily Dickinson at the start of the book, life is a spell so exquisite, everything conspires to break it. Mm-hmm. Or let me say it once more. Life is a spell so exquisite that everything conspires to break it. So that said, I think there is a kind of happiness that may transcend the absolutely fleeting and ephemeral quality of happiness. I think it takes time to realize that kind of happiness, but it's the happiness that comes from within, not circumstance. it's so all-encompassing that there's this profound acceptance of sorrow, sorrows of our own and others, but that the love of life is its own source of happiness, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So I wanted to span sort of from the emotional to the mystical, you might say.
Would you like to talk about some of the poems that you've so graciously read for us? And just like how they came to be and what they mean?
Yes, certainly.
And now we will listen to Halibut Point.
Halibut Point, for Gary. On a wooded path to the sea, beyond the quarry, a black butterfly leads us to the jagged slabs of stone that slope to water's edge. Barnacled, the seaweed-soaked granite glistens, deep brown as wet fur. When late afternoon light gives way to cold, we turn back, stopping at the edge of the quarry's deep pool to watch the sunset. As counterpoint to chilling air, the fiery horizon, crashing waves silent at a distance. In stillness, we stay through the glow. Intimate yet vast, the elemental touch that holds the world and us together. Not in this hour alone, of course, but this time, you tell me what you know in every cell is well-being, the order of things, each and every in its place, in its time, belonging. The fight goes out of you for an hour or more. Peace abiding, spray of the surge, sunset, first stars will be forgotten again and again. Tide going out, you take my hand. Halibut Point feels quite important and speaks to this topic I've just been addressing. It describes a real life event in a very beautiful place, a specific place in Rockport, Massachusetts, and a place my husband and I loved to go. And this one memory will stay with me, I think, always. And it was really his epiphany that in that beautiful setting, with the cold and the warmth of the sunset beauty, where he had one of those peak experiences of everything belonging in its own time and place, just the rightness of the world, even with its wrongs, you know, if that's possible, that sort of overarching intuition about the nature of life. And of course, it doesn't last even till the end of the poem. But I took notes for that poem well before my husband had a very terrible accident, and he was riding his bicycle and was hit by a pickup truck. And that landed him in the hospital for 3.5 months, and you know, with some very great injuries, including a traumatic brain injury. And it tested me in every possible way. And it was during the time he was in the hospital that I went back to work on this poem because I remembered his vision. So it's one thing that when things are peaceful and beautiful and loving, and we can just feel all is right with the world. But now what happens when something catastrophic happens and he nearly lost his life and has had repercussions from that serious accident? How can I make meaning of it? If not make meaning of it, because not all suffering seems meaningful per se, but how can I have a deep acceptance? Because if I fight against it, say this shouldn't have happened, that is going to drain my life force, which I need every single day to walk back in that hospital to see him in some terrible conditions along the long road of healing. So that's how the poem actually came about, and I know it was healing for me to actually write it and stay with it. And so that's the genesis of that.
And now we have Waiting Between Worlds.
Waiting Between Worlds. While you watched me sleep, I felt you pick up pieces of the life I'd lost. The wind sounded like that again tonight, ripping the darkness, then dying so far down the silence hurt. I was adrift, a piece of sky at dusk, fading. Where was I? You called my name, and I almost remembered a mother to her child, sister to brother, lover to lover, with words I couldn't hear clearly, but your voice moved inside me, gave me direction like rain, choosing the earth. Your words fell into me like rain. Then Waiting Between Worlds is actually my imagination of what my husband was going through. So for a while, I didn't know if he could hear me speak to him. Mm-hmm. I didn't know if he felt my presence. But of course, I was compelled to go and to be there and to keep talking to him and loving him and encouraging him. And so one day I just found myself thinking about his point of view, being between the worlds. You know, he hadn't died, but he wasn't really in his body the way we can be embodied as our lively, vital selves. So that's how that poem came to be. And that one actually, I think, was published in Snapdragon, a journal for healing in the arts. Mm. So that's, yeah. And you already know now how Happiness, a Strange Bird came about. Yeah.
Kind of going off of that, what was your favorite poem in the book? Or if not favorite, what was the most fulfilling or impactful to write?
Well, in this moment, having just talked about Halibut Point, I can say maybe that's what the poem I needed the most at that time in my life. Another poem which is very close to my heart is called Blue is a Being. And it was inspired by a vision that a dear friend of mine had. And so it was kind of a privilege to hear about her experience of this awe-inspiring presence of blue in her greatness, in her majesty. And I was so intrigued by how my friend spoke. You know, if you meet a great angel, what on earth are you going to ask? And so I won't give away her question and answer, but it stayed with me for many years. That's an older poem. Mm-hmm. And I think of it, and in the past I had some performances with wonderful harpist, and that's one of the poems I loved reading, with harp sort of coming in and out and surrounding it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Do you have any plans for like future books or poems or publications?
Yes. I feel I'm already working on my second book.
That's wonderful.
And many of my poems didn't make it into Happiness, a Strange Bird. But also I'm writing new poems.
Yes.
And I encourage you sometimes to challenge each other in terms of writing productivity. And some years ago, I had heard about this, the challenge of, you know, say writing 30 poems in 30 days.
Yeah, I'm doing that right now.
Are you doing? Yeah, that's so great. And so I've done that a number of times. Sometimes there were three of us, sometimes two of us. And recently, it was, in a way, it was hard timing because I was very busy at the time. I was even completing this book. Mm-hmm. And my dear friend Alice B. Fogel, who was Poet Laureate of New Hampshire for a number of years, and she thought, oh, I should, she was feeling I need to jumpstart my writing, and said, what about doing one of our poem a day exchanges? And we sort of changed the rules a little bit, but it was great. I somehow, once I have that kind of structure and a trusted writer friend, I suddenly discipline just comes to me. I will not go to sleep until that poem is, you know, that draft of a poem is underway. So I'm happy for you that you're doing that. Yeah. Oh, so yeah, so the next book. I have some readings coming up. And also, I have some prose that I would like to return to that I wrote also quite a while ago, where I was exploring three modernist poets and how their poetry was transporting in a way and helped us to have a more mystical experience of the whole. That words, which are so rooted in our senses, can be gateways to sort of bigger, greater experiences. And I think I'd like to go back to it and see if I could maybe expand upon it or break it down into essay form. So those are some of my hopes.
When did you first fall in love with poetry?
I fell in love with poetry in high school, and I would give a lot of credit to Shakespeare's sonnets. Mm-hmm. I'm so happy to see the nod. I just was crazy about T.S. Eliot for some reason, mm-hmm. and E.E. Cummings. Later on, I'd say early in college, Emily Dickinson won my heart. But Walt Whitman probably also still in high school. But I'd say one of the great things was falling in love with poetry, yes, which included falling in love with words. That words became beings, mm-hmm. things, like they're not just ink.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And, you know, we know when we speak, there's all this energy. But I think I was grabbed by the power of the words' music. Well, of course, something like Shakespeare or later Gerard Manley Hopkins. So this this beautiful relationship between sounds, and of course we get image as the painters do, but then we have sound as musicians do. Dylan Thomas has a great piece about being a child and falling for words. And even the nursery rhymes didn't matter how much what they said, but that the sounds on his ear were like sounds of nature and dynamic and endlessly fascinating, which is something that, of course, you know, his poetry expresses as well. Yeah, so I think that probably 16 and 17 were the biggest mm-hmm. years. And in fact, knowing I was going to speak to you, I didn't get to it, but I thought about going back to look for one of my earliest poems, which miraculously, I think I have a poem from, you know, being 17, and going to the ocean with friends, and just that full moonlight on the water, mm-hmm, and just the birth of poetry is right there, as Whitman beautifully expresses in his poems, so.
What advice do you have for young poets about writing poetry or finding their way in the writing and publishing world?
Yeah, those are two very different questions.
Yeah, that's a very good question.
But I was thinking about it. I think if you have a passion for poetry, as we've been sharing, or I've been sharing with you, and you're nodding with me, understanding, so much is possible. And it's very important not to fall into comparison and criticism too soon. And it's always too soon to fall into that trap, because if we love the words and we love what we're doing, we're going to also, if not love, we'll have a cordial relationship with revision and with editing. And to that point, I have been so blessed, and I hope you will be, to have to not just be alone with my work. I mean, we are alone when the poem arrives, or we conceive of it, we begin it. But sometimes before the end, so we share a draft, and we know, well, it's not exactly where we want it, but, you know, I'm going to read it to a friend.
Mm-hmm.
So to have trusted friends to share poems with could be painters, artists, just people who like poetry. It doesn't have to be a fellow poet, but that helps. I think that if there are people in your life that can receive, take your words to heart, and then give you an honest response, it really helps you to know. If your friend says, I really loved that, da 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 da, but I didn't understand that, can you clarify it? And you clarify, and they're like, that's it, write that down. So I have had, as I say, I mean, later in my life more so, such great help with refining my poetry. Writers that I really, really admire. And sometimes just those other eyes and ears saying, why did you choose that word? And I suddenly think, yes, why? You know, we do some things unconsciously. And so people are allies. You know, the words aren't just personal to us. We don't own them, per se.
Yeah.
And so I would just say, don't be afraid to include other people in your creative process. If someone says to you, I love that, but this one word, like, would you, you know, and you can even brainstorm. And I think the Japanese were great at that, where they would have these incredible gatherings and for haiku. And it wasn't that people had the same feeling of ownership, and people really, like, contributed to making the poems as great as they could be. So, yes, that would be one thing. The other thing about publishing, and I feel I am not an expert on this, but there are two things that really helped me, and I would encourage also younger writers. One is, if you have a poet you admire very much, see where she's publishing. So, for example, Alice, who I mentioned. So I have her books, and I can look at her acknowledgments page. And if you feel you have some resonance with that poet, something compatible, you know, okay, well, she's done the research. And some of my publications go back from getting ideas from a friend or looking at a number of books, which I do now. Other poets that I like, who I see where they're publishing, and I want to try those places. The other thing is, which has happened to me just more recently, actually, is, for example, I've had a couple of poems published in Pensive, a global journal of spirituality and the arts. And I was just excited to find a place that I felt that I so connect with that as an overview, as a mission, or, as I mentioned, Snapdragon. So if you have a niche, you may be able to find those journals who are especially featuring that kind of imagistic work and with those larger concerns. So those, I guess, would be my two thoughts. The community feeling as a writer, don't feel you are just alone. And the other thing, one last thing about that, I'm going to forget the name of the poem. It may be the teacher, but W.S. Merwin, who to me was absolutely, I mean, I just admire him no end, one of the greatest 20th, 21st century writers. And he talks about being a student, I think at Princeton, and his teacher at one point saying to him, if you have to know if you're any good, don't write. And it goes back to what I was saying to you, like, don't hold yourself to an incredibly high standard. Just focus on the work. And in this particular poem, the very famous teacher won't say, so just get down on your knees, you know what I mean? So you're humbled. You're not expecting to write the greatest poem of the 21st century, but you're devoted to it, and that is going to be your North Star.
How did you know the book was ready?
I'll tell you a little story about my struggle to make it ready, because my perfectionist streak came out in its wickedness. And I was getting very close. I mean, it was supposed to be ready to just go. And Mike Nelson, the publisher, said to me, I was having my, supposedly a last meeting with him, and the night before, I sat there with the book, and I found maybe, 30 things that I wanted to edit. And I'm not even exaggerating, a comma, or, you know what I mean, or, you know, kill the semicolons, I'm over them, well, now and so I had all of this, and Mike was just fantastic and talked, you know, editing can be addictive, you know, but he was, you know, going to help me out with this. He was great to work with in that way, too. But he used a great image, which did me a world of good. And he actually referred to the Great British Baking Show, which I don't know if you're familiar with.
Yes, yeah.
But he said, okay, so occasionally there will be a cake that is just magnificent, and the judges will say, you know, this cake is so beautiful, it belongs top tier in a Parisian bakery. And he said, no, okay, listen to me. Right now, your book is your cake. It is beautiful. It is frosted. And you are moving around the sprinkles. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, okay. Thank you for helping me move the sprinkles. Now we're going to serve it up. Mm. Let it go. So, yeah, it took a little bit. I think that's one thing also, though, to encourage students, students, young writers, I had a tendency to hold back too much and was very judgy. And so I feel like much freer at this point in my life, but don't wait as long as I did to send your work far and wide, and believe in yourself, and don't keep moving the sprinkles around.
Recording.
So Nora and Sam, I want to thank you not only for the interview, but for being fellow writers, which means really taking care with words, having reverence for words. And in these times we're in, as you know, language is in a troubled state. The idea of having reverence and a clarity around truth, have spoken word come from the heart to the heart, that can't be taken for granted. And I know that what you two are doing with many other writers and artists and good folks serving others, are keeping words alive as expressions of soul and your deepest truth. So thank you both very much.
You've been listening to an episode of Touchstone Talk from the Poetry Society of New Hampshire. You can hear other episodes and the audio editions of our latest issue of Touchstone, and hear more about poetry events in New Hampshire at psnh.org.